I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. It's my great delight to welcome today to Conversing Dr. Shirley Hoekstra. Shirley is the president of the Council of Christian Colleges and Universities, which is based in Washington, D.C. She has been in this role since 2014, and she ends up leading in this role 180 Christian colleges and universities across America with influence around North America and around the world in a very, very important time, and it's a delight to welcome her.
Thank you, Mark. It's just a privilege to be in conversation with you today.
I am a great admirer of yours and of the work of the CCCU because at a time when higher education itself is undergoing so much change and Christian higher education is undergoing so much change, the chance to talk to somebody who's right at the vortex of all of that, which you are every day, is really a great treat. So I want to come to some of the things about the work that you're currently doing, but some of the people who are listening to this may not know about the CCCU. I wonder if you can just give us a brief overview of its history, and then we'll come to the challenges that are before you today.
Well, it's actually a providential story, as so many of these things are. When you look in the rearview mirror, you see what God was thinking about 43 years ago. He imagined in the hearts of some of the leading evangelical leaders a desire to bring Christian higher education together so that they could be stronger and unified and therefore an influence, first in government, but then second of all, an influence to make sure that all the schools were at their best through professional development, through integration of faith and learning. And then thirdly, there was now, remember, about 40 plus years ago, not everybody had study abroad programs on their own campuses. And so the council initiated a Washington, D.C. program called American Studies Program. They initiated a Latin American Studies Program. And now we have over 9 programs around the world, in Uganda, in Oxford, in Australia, in Northern Ireland and Uganda, and then also in the important cities, Washington, D.C., as I mentioned, and L.A., and also in Nashville, because there's nothing really better learning about how things operate in the, you use a lot of the time, the kingdom of God phrase, Mark. Knowing how to do that with experiential education is probably the highest and best, sort of best practice in education. So we do that, and we do that on behalf, and let me just give you a couple of specifics. Over 180 institutions are in the CCCU. We educate over 450,000 students a year. Over $1 billion of donations are given every year for the advancement of this work. And we are internationally located. We're in North America, both Canada and the United States. So we are the voice of Christian higher education in the world today that also does what we call advocacy, professional development, experiential education.
It's just an amazing portfolio. One of the things that I've always admired about the work of the CCCU is that it really does hold such a broad vision. So on the one hand, it's about the work of individual campuses, but on the other, it's an acknowledgement that there's a whole industry, an enormous industry called Christian higher education, and that it has important intersections with government and with American culture, really more broadly. Where are the clusters, if there are central clusters of Christian colleges, what are some of the main regions where you find the bulk of them?
Well, I'm actually looking at this map of the United States and of Canada, because I'll start there. On the West Coast, we have a beautiful constellation of schools in California, in Oregon, in Washington State, and in Idaho. And then as you move east, we really are all over that Midwest belt. Mm-hmm. So they're in Minnesota, in Iowa, in Kansas, in Oklahoma. We have 9 plus schools in Texas, Arkansas, and then go up the East Coast, and you'll find us in all those beautiful states, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, on up the coast in Pennsylvania and New York, and then over again to Michigan and those Midwest, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, et cetera.
Right.
And then in Canada, we're in Manitoba, we're in Saskatchewan, we're in Alberta, and then the 20 plus countries around the world. And in some ways, just like the church, Christian higher education is getting a real toehold in the international places where the church is growing.
Right, right, exactly. So Shirley, when you wake up in the morning and you begin to think about your schedule, and obviously on any given day, it's, I'm sure, packed with various things, but you think about the main pain points or challenge points facing the CCCU, what would they be? Just take us to your short list of maybe the top three or four things that just immediately come to your mind.
Well, I read the newspapers every morning, and then I read the papers that are specifically for higher education. And, you know, Mark, what's interesting is that some of the same pressure points for Christian higher education are the pressure points for higher education generally. So access to education and affordability and keeping great scholars and teachers, making sure that there's enough sustainable funds so that not only are they operating well today, but they're operating for the next 5, 15, 25, 50 years. That decisions today are really stewardly, that they're addressing the cultural issues of racism and diversity and inclusion and safe spaces and all those kinds of questions that come up are about human beings learning together. And so some of those, of course, are in Christian higher education. We have sort of an added extra pinch point, as you say, because higher education is so highly regulated. Think about it, food and housing, and because of financial aid that goes to students, the Americans should feel rightly concerned about where all of those tax dollars go for financial aid to students. But Christian colleges are countercultural in many ways. And one of the ways in which they are countercultural is that their mission, a Christian mission, is the most important thing that helps to shape the daily decisions of a school. And for our Christian colleges, one of the pinch points is this living out of a human sexual ethic that is countercultural in terms of marriage being between a man and a woman versus believing that marriage can be broader than that, even though civilly we accept that and we obey the laws of the land. But within a cultural context of our individual schools, the privilege of teaching that marriage is between a man and a woman for so many biblical reasons, even though people differ on that, good, reasonable theologians, in a biblically honoring mission statement that our schools have, we become countercultural.
Right.
And so I want to just tell a couple of stories that might be surprising to the listeners. And this is something that I was unaware of. I worked on a campus for 15 years. I was unaware really about how much government is regulating this industry. And I want to tell you three stories that just happened. So with Mike Pompeo being now offered up and nominated to be the Secretary of State, many people may have realized that Senator Cory Booker was questioning, who is now Cabinet Member Pompeo, and made the assertion that because Mike Pompeo held a traditional understanding of marriage and that he had an understanding of salvation that was particular to a Christian, that Senator Booker suggested that maybe he wasn't qualified to be a member of Cabinet. Interestingly, that follows on a situation that happened last year where Senator Bernie Sanders also raised the question about whether a man named Russell Vogt, who was going to be confirmed for the Office of Budget and Management, because he held to a Christian understanding that salvation is through Jesus Christ, he was not qualified to serve in government. And just before that, Senator Feinstein raised the same question about whether law professor at Notre Dame, who was really highly regarded without question, Amy Coney Barrett, was nominated for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. And Senator Feinstein basically said that because of her personal beliefs, that she would be unqualified to be a judge on the federal circuit. Now, all of these people, except we don't know about Mike Pompeo yet, but Russell Vogt and Amy Coney Barrett, they were confirmed But what is alarming, and I'm not an alarmist, but what was alarming is three very popular and influential senators were raising a specter that Christians, and these are the kinds of Christians that are in my schools, that are in your institution, that are people who take their faith seriously and live out their faith, that they would not be qualified to serve in government.
Right.
So when I think about that, I think, can we continue to hire the kinds of institutional people that we need to hire? Can our graduates get a degree that allows them to work in all areas of life according to their calling? So this is one of the things that we have some solutions for.
CCCU, you mean?
The CCCU is actively operating around solutions to that very new problem in the intersection between government and mission.
Yes. So I know that, for example, there's been bills that have been threatening to come before the California legislature or have been before the California legislature, which have been examples of some of those pressure points. And you've given three great examples of individual people serving. So when the CCCU acknowledges that its context of its work has shifted in the way that those examples imply, then what are the ways that the CCCU can best address those concerns, do you think?
Well, my belief is there's nothing by accident in God's sovereignty. And the fact that Christian colleges and, by extension, other Christian mission-minded organizations are under some pressure tells us that maybe we haven't told our story clearly enough.
Yes.
And I believe that our institutions who advance faith and intellect for the common good, we have not told the story about how we are offering an indispensable kind of graduate for the flourishing and well-being of neighborhoods and cities and communities and towns and counties and state governments and national governments.
Right.
What we do know is that our graduates are hired at a very high rate because people love the kind of graduate that, you know, understands their heart, soul, mind, right?
Yes.
Well, and so one of the things that we're doing is we're getting the word out and we make the case for Christian higher education, because when people hear about the ways in which we've already contributed to society, whether it's through the arts or through leadership in national companies or whether it's in sports, they say, wow, they are not closed-minded, bigoted people.
Right.
They are people who hold fast to things that matter.
Right.
And so, in fact, I love this quote by Richard Foster, who said, we don't need any more geniuses. We need people with deep souls.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And Christian higher education is actually, I believe, of course, I'm biased, but I believe is one of the best avenues to creating deep souls.
Mm-hmm.
People who will stay in a text and study it, people who understand solitude, people who honor the Sabbath, people who like to think about a boundary life, not a frenetic life.
Right.
People who think about moderation.
Right.
Right. All of these make good citizens. And so that's one of the first things we're doing.
Right. Right. Which is continuing to develop the kind of character and lifestyle that's reflective of a deep-souled life.
Exactly. So, exactly. And yeah.
So I think one of the things that's so striking about that is that it does, just to highlight the implications of what you've just said, it is then not just a product, clearly, that you're trying to turn out of a certain person with a certain kind of education or knowledge or technique, but it's really the formation of a person with a capacity to go as that real soul into a whole variety of places with knowledge and skills, but a deep rootedness that they bring to the place that they're going to serve. Is that a reasonable summary of what you're trying to get at?
That's exactly right.
I think that's the mystery, right? Because even when you read the New Testament carefully, it's very interesting to just ask the question, what is really forming the disciples for the future that they don't expect and don't anticipate and is going to consume them literally as they move forward? And over time, obviously, the church across Roman Catholic and Protestant circles in every kind of denomination has had, as Richard Foster calls it, different streams of spirituality mm-hmm. that have been encouraged. So mm-hmm. let's go in that direction for just a minute before we come back to the wider public space. So you look across the landscape of these 180 schools. Is that the right number, 180 schools?
Mm-hmm.
And you think about the variety of denominational and theological perspectives of these various institutions, and yet there is this kind of soulish center that you're describing that's about being on mission in some deep way related to and centered in Jesus Christ. Give us some examples of the varied ways that that kind of formation you think can best be encouraged through Christian higher education. I think many listeners might have an idea of how it does or doesn't happen in the context of churches or neighborhoods or families, but how does it happen on a campus?
Right. So first of all, as you know, when a group of people can get together and they sort of agree in advance that they have some common commitments.
Yes.
This allows people to actually encourage and correct people when they are living out those common commitments.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the most loving things that people can do is actually not just encourage, but correct. How many times do you have a person in your life that loves you well enough and knows you well enough to say, you know, Shirley or Mark, you know, you've committed to this, but it seems like, you know, you're acting in a way that's contradictory to that. Is that how you really want to be? And it's that kind of common commitment that the men and women who live in our residence halls and then study together in their classes, most of our campuses have a small faculty-staff ratio. They have faculty who are tenured long-term that know them well. And they talk about the incongruence of what you believe and how you act as a regular conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of those ways in which we shape ourselves. Another way is Christian college students actually participate in service learning at a higher degree than any other set of students in higher education.
Wow.
Here's an example. There was a group of students who, as part of their project in their engineering class, heard about a man with ALS who had lost his ability to speak to his family, even though he had a number of months and perhaps years to live. So they went in and they said, you know what, we think that we can devise for you a way that you will be able to communicate with your family.
Hmm.
And that happened just because those four students came in and found a solution to that person's issue.
Hmm.
We have projects that can integrate not just an economic kind of advantage, although many of our students go into business and finance, but also sort of social solutions, because it comes out of the sort of biblical understandings of, you know, mercy and justice and
right.
love that permeate.
Right.
So we find a high degree of our students are not only training to be academically well-suited, but choosing professions that actually advance the common good through the education or social work, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that strikes me about what you're saying is that, well, it cuts across many denominations. I know that you have been deeply shaped by the Reformed tradition. I have too, in a different brand, but the same general vein. And, you know, one of the primary documents of that is the Heidelberg Catechism and its opening question about what is your only hope in life and in death. And that it begins, as you know, with the phrase that I belong not to myself, but to my faithful Savior, Jesus Christ. And one of the things about that phrase is that it is so deeply countercultural. So as a person who was a pastor in Berkeley for the better part of three decades, I'm deeply aware that there's nothing more countercultural than in Berkeley to say, you do not belong to yourself. That is just its own astounding difference. And what you're partly describing is a landscape of how Christian higher education helps form a background and a deep soil of formation in which your life is written against the deep soil of God's grace, the deep soil of culture and human beings created in God's image, the deep soil of what it means to be self-reflective and self-critical as well as self-offering. All of that comes together across the many disciplines of Christian higher education. So what I think is so compelling about that kind of vision is that it has the potential of such deep integration. And that's at least what I'm hearing. Is that a fair summary?
Oh, it's just amazing that you would raise that question, one, about our catechism, because just Sunday, I was graced by Pastor Reggie Smith to talk about the fact that we are not our own. Think about, you know, what is your only comfort in life and in death? Is that we are not our own, but belong, right, to
right.
something, someone else, right? So right away, it actually is the antidote to narcissism.
Right. Right.
It's the antidote to thinking that I am the most important. It's what I want to do. It takes the I out. And think about how counterculture this is. How do I submit my life to right. someone other than myself?
Right.
I'm submitting to someone who already says, I love you so much that I gave my life for you. I want the best for you. I want you to flourish. And I've given you the scriptures to help you figure out what's the best way to flourish. So this owning part, which in some ways could have a negative piece about it when you think certainly about the U.S. history of, you know, other people owning other people, but we are the beloved of someone who loves us perfectly. And so we get to submit ourselves in a way that allows us freedom.
Right.
It's that paradoxical message of the scriptures.
Right, right. Well, it's quite a countercultural thing. This is, to me, the heart of what distinguishes Christian higher education from other things. It's not that we study other disciplines or that there's something called, quote, Christian physics, as opposed to non-Christian physics. There's physics. But we come to physics, or we come to theology, or we come to history, or we come to sociology, or we come to math and technology through the lens of saying, if all of this, if the totality of reality belongs to a God of mercy and love and justice, then how do I find and steward my life in the context of that deep, varied, and integrated reality, as opposed to how do I make my life, find my dreams, make up my hopes? There's space for, obviously, individual creativity, but more importantly than that, there's this spaciousness for what the imagination and heart of God has designed into creation itself and into the creation of any given individual with all of their gifts and abilities. This is why I think the place of Christian higher education is so profound. I don't think it's for everyone, but I definitely think for people that are on that journey and find that kind of stimulus needed and important, it's remarkably satisfying to think that this enterprise actually exists, even knowing that, of course, like Fuller itself, that it's not ever able to fully live into this reality of what we're trying to be and do. But the vision of it is such a constant one, I think. And I'm just so grateful for what is being done, even given what you've described as the challenges inherent in doing so.
Well, and Mark, one of the reasons why Christian higher education actually has so much support from our other higher education colleagues, so the American Council on Education and National Associations of Independent Colleges and Universities, the Council of Independent Colleges, Hispanic Association of Colleges and Universities, we all feel the value of each other's expression, a diverse expression in higher education.
Right.
So like you said, it's not for everyone, but I would want a student to be able to go to a Hispanic serving institution.
Yes.
I would want a student to be able to go to a historically Black college. I would want a student who said, no, that's where I'm led. I'm led to that small private secular institution because I think that's where I can get my gifts and talents. And all of those other secular organizations say, we think students should be able to also have a deeply rooted, Christ-centered, faith-based education if that's where they're called. And because we see each other's value making up this diverse melting pot of what's called American higher education. And that's why we want to get our story out.
Yes.
Because we think that, and I'll say next to the church, I believe Christian higher education offers a hope to the world.
Right.
Because of Jesus Christ.
Amen. Amen. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you know, the central Christian confession that Jesus is Lord can either sound like it's really the ultimate in myopia, or if you understand it, I would argue biblically, it's the invitation that cracks open the whole of reality. And it's one or it's the other. And if it's the tribal vision, the small tribal vision, the local petty godling who's the godling over my little tribe, then,
right.
then that reality closes down the possibilities of imagination, inventiveness, creativity, beauty, wonder, awe, discovery, etc. But if it's actually the key that cracks open reality, then it's actually the thing that invites us into an infinitely wider and deeper space than almost any other invitation. And it's amazing to me that that same confession plays in such opposite ways. So a lot of the catalysts that I think we're certainly going for at Fuller, and that I think is part of the CCU in general, we're just an affiliate member, but to the degree that we are representative of that mission of the CCCU broadly, I think everyone in the institution of the CCCU would want to see it as something that breaks open reality rather than something that closes it down. And yet there's such a tendency, for the reasons that you were giving about the change of language. So why does Dianne Feinstein say what she does? Because she thinks that the confession that Jesus is Lord closes down compassion, mercy, and justice, as opposed to opening those things, right? So right. That's for the storytelling.
Yeah, but partly that's on us, don't you
Absolutely,
think?
Absolutely, yeah.
Has, right?
Right.
So how well are we telling the outcomes of our educational opportunities?
Yes, yes.
And to say that actually academic freedom should be largest in a faith-based or Christ-centered education.
Right.
Because actually, if God is Lord of all, then you should be able to ask the largest possible question.
Right.
You should be looking to see God in the largest possible problem.
Yes.
And that you don't have to be afraid of where those answers will bring you, but that you should be like excited or anticipate where those answers will bring you.
Right.
And perhaps we need to tell that story better, because sometimes you see the bumpers before you see the horizon.
Yes, yes.
When That's you well think put. About it. So,
right.
And we need to be self-critical,
right.
too.
Absolutely.
Like, where aren't we doing that well? Or
right.
where have we gotten afraid?
Right, right. Let's pick up on that theme of fear, because A, it's pervasive in our culture and in the world, and sometimes it seems to be most pervasive in the Christian church, that is fear. And some people, at least, perhaps unfairly, would look at CCCU schools and say, people choose to go to CCCU schools out of fear of being in a secular university environment. I'm sure you must hear people say that. When you hear that, and you're wanting to shape the mission of the CCCU as president of the organization, how do you engage that kind of critique? Is it fair? Is it legitimate? Is it completely wrong? Is it some of both? How do you engage that?
Yeah, so people rarely come into any organization with one motive or one hope, right? So what we find is the predominant reason for students and families to enter into the stream of Christian education is because, let's take the public school student. So they've gone to school K through 12 in a secular environment, and yet their faith really is vital to them and means a lot to them. And then they have this idea presented that you could actually study for the next 4 or 5 years in a place where people are not going to ask you to have your faith as an invisible part of your life, but actually as a central part of your life. And the faculty and the staff, then the whole conversation is actually going to celebrate this idea that faith enlivens your academic discussions. And actually, it's not the opposite, that it somehow diminishes them.
Right.
So that's really one exciting. I'll see many public school students who come and say, I had no idea that I could live so fully into my curiosity and discovery.
Yes, yes.
You might have some parents who say, you know, look, I don't want my students sort of polluted by these ideas that don't have any resonance with the values we have. But at a good Christian higher education institution, they're going to examine the ideas that are both in the academy, the secular academy. They're going to look at those ideas from a number of points of view. So Christian colleges are not a place to shelter. They're actually just a place that has clarity about where the values lie
right.
in the lives of the participants.
Right. So it's really about how do you stimulate the growth at the very center of a person's life with enough
right.
depth that
That's
they have
right.
the strength and capacity to engage any and all comers.
Well, and this, so the Higher Education Research Institute out at Stanford said, a great study out of 2011, said 70%, now this isn't Christian students, this is 70% of students in higher education, the whole max, they actually longed for their faculty and their classes to talk about spirituality. They actually had these big questions that they would like to address. And what they were finding is that Jonathan Haidt said recently at a conference, he believed, and he's a secular humanist, he said, everybody has a hole in their heart. And, you know, you want to find the answers, like, what's my life worth? Will I have meaning? What happens when I die? Is it just about money, or is there something more to my life that I can aim at and participate in? And in fact, David Brooks, I love a quote that he gave us. He said, everybody is desperate to have a way of talking about and educating the human person in a way that integrates faith, emotion, and intellect. And he mentioned that Christian higher education had that recipe to nurture human beings who had a devoted heart, a courageous mind, and a purposeful soul. Mm-hmm. And I just love this idea of devoted heart, you know, courageous mind, purposeful soul, not just an educated heart, mind, and soul.
Right, right. Yeah, that's an amazing description. And it certainly mm-hmm. flips on its head the instincts of what the rhetoric often would suggest about both Christian higher education on the one hand and a secular university environment on the other. I know that from being a pastor in Berkeley for so many years, that one of the things that was such a delight about being there was that it turns out that Berkeley students, as strident and opinionated and diverse as they are, shared in common much more frequently than not the hunger that you're describing, a desire mm-hmm. for, in a way, mm-hmm. an Augustinian vision of the world, right? An ability mm-hmm. to admit that at the core there is something that is beyond our capacity to simply manage or find a technique to resolve or a piece of information to satisfy. It's very, very profound. Shirley, if you go ahead, please.
No, well, this idea of like, who are you when you die? We just had recently, of course, Barbara Bush's funeral.
Yes.
We had Billy Graham's funeral. These were people of stature who contributed to the life of the world.
Right.
And what did people say about them? Right. They loved deeply.
Right.
They thought of others outside themselves. And I think David Brooks refers to them in his book on courage. They had the eulogy virtues.
Hmm.
Well, how do you shape a life? How do you form friends? Right. How do you make choices that when all is said and done, you have virtue?
Right.
In your life. It's not something you catch. It's something you learn and practice.
Right, right. Yeah. And that's where the community, both of faculty and of mm-hmm. other students,
right.
becomes so
right.
critical to the exercise. Absolutely.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So if you were to give us, as we come toward the close of this conversation, maybe one external challenge that if you could fix, you would most want to address, and one internal challenge that is internal to the CCCU work, what would be one challenge in each domain that our listeners might want to particularly know about and consider themselves?
An external challenge is that I would like this is a big category, so citizens or people who are operating day to day in this, what I believe is a wonderful system of government, the one that has the most potential for human flourishing in so many ways, which is this democracy.
Right.
I would love for us to be able to think deeply about what it means to live with differences. And that, how do I as a Christian respect deeply people who disagree with me and I disagree with them? How do I help people to not be dismissive of other people's deeply held beliefs? How can we create the way of talking and solving problems that actually elevates and doesn't denigrate?
Yes, yes.
I think that's the future
right.
for my institutions, right?
Right?
Because there are going to be people who disagree with our countercultural way of being, who might think it's naive or laughable. But I want them to take the time to say, well, I wonder what they have to offer people who choose that and offer us. And likewise, I want to ask, what does the atheist, what does the humanist, what does the person who right now has no value for religion, what are they bringing that's honorable and good and right?
Yes.
And I want to model us, and I want our campuses and our nation actually to model that sort of inquiry and curiosity and sort of withholding the quick judgment.
Yes, yes, yes.
Internally, I would love, if I could wave a magic wand, it would be that people would reorder their sense of generosity and contribute to causes like Christian higher education in such an abundance that there would be the largest of endowments. For what purpose? So that access to education for the first generation student, for the student that does not come from a wealthy home, would be able to get the kind of education that matched their faith values and their desire for vocation and calling.
Mm.
If I could wave a magic wand, because I actually think that there is God has actually given all the resources we need.
Right, right.
And I would love for us to be able to send those to those places that are making the biggest difference. And I think Christian higher education is one of those institutions that is going to make the biggest, a big difference in raising up leaders and raising up people who are out in every aspect of the culture. And I think it is going to be leaven for years and years to come.
Right, right.
So that's what I would, sustainability for our Christian mission-minded institution.
Yeah. Those are such great words, Shirley. Honestly, I mean, I think you've heard me talk about my own conviction that we've made a shift from Christendom to the church in America living in a context of exile, which I see as a highly motivating opportunity, not a tragedy. I think it's a huge challenge to make that shift. And part of the resistance to that shift is reflected in a lot of the politics and the rhetoric of the day. But if we can make that shift, then the two things that you've said, the ability to live with differences is essential if you're going to be a faithful exile. Mm-hmm. If you treat everyone that's around you with differences as the problem instead of the neighbor, that's a completely different reality. And if we can welcome everyone into the context of the kind of deep formation that you're talking about, that need and seek that without the boundaries that have kept institutions sometimes hampered in their generous mission, then that completely changes the landscape of how many people are formed and informed and able to fully participate. Really great words, Shirley. It just confirms all the more my huge gratitude that you are the president of this critically important organization at a vital time. And I thank you so much for this conversation. I pray for you often, and I know that some of the listeners to this may, if they haven't been praying for you, may feel highly motivated to want to pray for your mission to be strengthened, because it is really so important. Thank you so much for being part of this conversation today. You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.